Accession number 28457, Reel 6.
Nigel Matthews, Reel 6. You were talking about your training on Barracuda aircraft. Before we move on to your time in carriers, could you perhaps explain what your role as an observer involved in terms of preparation for a flight and what happened during a flight?
Yes. The sales pitch for observers was that they were going to do the job which, before aircraft came along, was done by cruisers. In other words, scouting out ahead of the fleet to try and find the enemy. This involved going out on predetermined tracks and searches which were put together by the ship's operations officer. And you then had to navigate the aircraft. And in fact, the pilot did what you told him to do. And I think I went into the question of wind finding in a previous reel. And that there was no radio that you were allowed to use because it was assumed that you would be in radio silence. So you really were the captain of the aircraft, although the pilot was always regarded as the captain.
What would you do to prepare for a flight?
Well, you had a certain amount of navigational equipment. A chart board, which was about 18 inches square, which had attached to it a ruler and a parallel ruler and a sort of compass rose to measure angles. And on this you could put a chart on which you could draw the lines that you needed for your tracks and courses. You also had a thing called a CSC, which was a sort of very primitive early form of calculator, which would enable you quickly to establish things like estimated times of arrival, how long it would take to go around. Because, of course, one of the important things was that you were always limited in range by the fuel, and so you didn't want to actually run out of fuel, and so you would be telling your pilot what to do. Getting back to the carrier, of course, was quite a skillful business because there were no aids. The carrier had a beacon, but this was not normally used. And indeed, it was a matter of pride with observers. They didn't use the beacon unless they simply had to. And there were many occasions on live operations when, in fact, the beacon was not switched on in the carrier. So he went off by dead reckoning, taking account of the wind, for which there was a special procedure. Very simple, very old-fashioned, but after practice, quite good. And when we trained off the coast of Scotland, one went round a predetermined course and track, and then your exercise could be quite accurately analysed by your instructors.
Why? By looking at how long it took you and...
Yes, how long it took and where you ended up. You always took departure from a given spot, which generally was a place called Fife Ness, which is just off the golf course at Carnoustie. And when you came back, having been on your tracks, you would have to take an accurate position from the land when you got back to it as to where you were. And this related to the time that you'd been airborne, the speed that you'd been going, the tracks that you'd gone, enabled you to establish, in fact, how far the aircraft had wandered off your intended course. And your intended course had been arrived at by calculating the wind. So if the wind was different, and wind finding was the most important aspect of this navigation, then that could be determined and established quite accurately in the analysis.
And how did you, when you were actually flying?
Yes.
How did you update the information, as it were, and how did you?
Just by time. I mean, you if you took departure and you noted the time precisely, and then you had to tell the pilot which courses he was to steer. And during training, you had, in fact, to go out for so long, or so many miles, you worked out how long it would take you. Depending on the wind strength, you'd have the course, which would also make allowance for the wind. And if you were lucky in that part of the off the east coast of Scotland, you would have a chance to fix your position from the Bell Rock Lighthouse, which was quite often visible.
What happened when you were flying over the sea, though?
Oh, just that. Nothing.
Nothing.
No, you left the ship. Well, actually, Pierre was skillful. It was amazing how after a bit, you did in fact become quite skillful at it. And, you would say, well, we should be seeing the carrier in 3 minutes on that sort of a bearing. And it was really rather gratifying when, in fact, you did. And you did that quite a lot of the time. On the other hand, when you lost the carrier, or couldn't find it, and you didn't have the beacon, if you're in really desperate states, you did a thing called a square search from the point where you thought you were with it, and you went around in ever-increasing circles until eventually you found it. In fact, I can't remember occasion when I failed to find the carrier, but that's just luck.
You were talking about training on barracudas
prior to
joining HMS Implacable.
Yes.
Was that the first aircraft carrier that you had joined, been a part of?
Yes, it was. In fact, Implacable was the second one because we did a sort of work-up cruise for the squadron in Formidable first because Implacable wasn't quite ready.
Was that a refit or was she a new vessel?
Implacable, she was new. And she was, I don't know what the problem was. But anyway, the actual embarkation was delayed by about a month, as I recall. And so we were put on board Formidable, which we joined, I think, at Scarpa. And she was already a fully-fledged operational carrier. And we did a sweep to Norway, in which it was expected that we were going to attack the Tirpitz. In the event, we didn't, and it was aborted. And then after that, we reformed at Macrahanish and flew on to Implacable for the first time. And that, well, it was a new ship, and we were her squadrons. And so the first thing we did was a work-up operation, which again was off the Norwegian coast, and we carried an armament of 12 barracudas and about 20 seafires and about 12 fireflies. Seafires were the fighters, of course, very unsuited to operating from carriers, really, because they didn't have the strength in the undercarriage. We had a number of accidents, but not too many fatalities. And the fireflies were a newish aeroplane, quite tough, built for a carrier by ferries, and they were strike aeroplanes, and they carried two of two. And then we had their strike was only cannons, and the strike aircraft, which at that time carried bombs or torpedoes, were the barracudas. And this strike off Norway involved the fireflies doing some attacks on shipping, and nothing came the way of the barracudas. And so they sent us off on a special operation to attack some German merchant shipping, which they hoped we would find, off the Lofoten Islands. And we did an absolutely standard torpedo attack, coming in from about 5,000 or 6,000 feet to sea level. And we did, in fact, drop a torpedo which sank a merchant ship at anchor. But in making good our escape, we turned out from the anchorage over a pier, at the end of which there was an anti-aircraft carrier, a battery. And the aircraft that I was in was hit in the wing root, and quite a lot of shrapnel after the explosion came into the back cockpit, where the observer was sitting. That was his position. and the air gunner was further aft in the aeroplane with access to a Lewis gun or machine gun of some sort to repel fighters if any came your way. I received a certain amount of shrapnel in the buttocks and the thigh, but very small bits. However, there was a certain amount of loss of blood, and the drill was that under these conditions, you carried inside your May West a small phial of morphia, which was you were briefed that if anybody was hurt or injured, you were to be injected with this morphia. And the air gunner quite rightly pumped me with a shot of morphia, which was fine. I didn't lose consciousness, but it was a splendidly euphoric ride back to the carrier, which, despite the damage, which barracudas were very susceptible to, the pilot, who was the squadron commander, Alan Swanton, was extremely skillful, and he brought us back to the carrier about 50 miles out to sea. When we landed, he had, of course, told the carrier by radio that they had me in the back in a bad way. And I was pounced upon by a number of eager sailors, including an SPA, that's a sick berth attendant, who in his enthusiasm gave me another shot of morphia. The drill was you were supposed to have an M painted on your forehead by whoever had done the first injection. Well, there was no way of doing this in the airplane, so he didn't know. So I nearly became a morphine addict, I suppose. However, the wounds were superficial, and although I still carry three bits of shrapnel in my thigh and my buttock, I went through a period of about 3 weeks during which I was evacuated by ship to the naval hospital at King's Seat near Aberdeen, and after a bit went back home for a week's leave and back to the ship.
What treatment did you receive?
Oh, well, they sewed me up and they took out, I think, one piece. And then the doctor, this was on board, of course, said that he thought they'd leave them there. And if they wanted to extract them with the experts in the hospital, they would do so. But when they got it there, they decided they would leave it because they felt that they were not harming anything vital. And I never had any pain from them since. There is an amusing sideline to this about... 3 or 4 years ago, I had an operation on my spine called a spinal decompression in Haslam, the Royal Hospital at Gosport. And one of the surgeons, registrars, was German. He had been imported to sort of back up the medical staff. He was very correct. Rather sort of like a caricature almost of a German. And in the course of his examination, he found the scars on my thigh and asked me where I got these from. So I told him that I had received them through the activities of a compatriot of his. I was very surprised that far from smiling or thinking the thing was a joke, he behaved in what was a sort of caricature of Teutonic humour and said absolutely nothing. He was furious. And he hardly spoke to me ever again. He only saw me about a few times, but it was an interesting sideline. He was the epitome of the sort of caricature of a German.
How long after war was that?
Oh, this was 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh. So it's sort of 55.
Well, I mean, I suppose it was an English joke about, yeah. You know. He probably thought it was something he wouldn't want to mention.
Yeah.
And if you're on the losing side, I suppose it is conceivable that you might feel like it. But anyway, that was his reaction, which amused me and surprised me. Now, back to the...
Yes, could you describe the structure of the squadron? The hierarchy and the number of people who were involved?
Well, we might as well go in the carrier, I think. Really, the carrier, well, the aircraft in the carrier are its armament. And so you have the captain of the ship, who is normally, but not always, an aviator. You have a chap called the Commander Air, who is the head of the flying department. And then he has a team on the flight deck, lieutenant commander flying, who is in charge of everybody on the flight deck, who guides the aircraft, controls them, gets them up from the hangar and down again. In the squadrons themselves, the structure is that you have a commanding officer of the squadron, and if you're a fighter, single-seater fighter, you just have a number of pilots, which probably in a squadron of 12, which is the normal size, you would have two who are more experienced than others, and a number of quite newly trained pilots. And the same would apply to the other aircraft and squadrons leading up to your strike aircraft, which carried the bombs. And they normally had three people, an observer, a senior observer. Each aircraft had an observer, because although you went out in formation, you quite often got separated, and you were far enough away from the ship that, unlike the fighters, which always remained on the end of a radio link and were told what to do, the strike aircraft were expected to go off anything up to a couple hundred miles away, perhaps at maximum range, and operate quite independently. And you had an air gunner as well, in case you were attacked, and not that he would ever expect to do much good.
Were you integrated into the ship's company, or were you effectively breed apart?
Good question. We were integrated in the ship's company, and we regarded ourselves as implacable squadron. And backing up the squadron, of course, the squadron had its own maintenance crews, and they were quite large. I mean, if you had 12 aircraft, you probably had a maintenance crew of between 60 to 100 men, and they would vary from one air engineer officer, probably maybe an assistant, a number of chief petty officers and petty officers, and then they just met the mechanics. And they were part of the squadron, but they belonged to the ship, and they regarded themselves as attached to the ship. But you could, if you wanted to, if your ship was sunk, damaged, out of action, or you wanted to transfer them, then you could take the squadron as a complete unit with all its men and just put them into another ship. The aircrew, of course, would fly, but you had to arrange for the squadron personnel to be transported by some other means. It might be a ship, it might be just because they walked across the airfield or something like that.
Did you live in the same quarters as the...
Yes, the officers and ratings lived in... we had an aircrew mess. There was an aircrew room where you sat and got your briefings, and they were for the aircrew. But the ship is one.
There was a separate mess?
No, you lived in the wardroom.
You lived in the wardroom?
Yes. The aircrew were all officers. At least the pilots and observers were all officers. There was the very, very occasional rating pilots, and they lived on the mess decks, or in the petty officers' mess. The air gunners were all ratings, but they could be anything up to chief petty officers. And they lived in the aircrew senior rates mess, for example. But the officers were integrated with the wardroom, and one dined together, ate together, breakfasted together, and drank together.
Can you describe the process of preparing an aircraft for an operation takeoff?
Yes. Well, the night before, generally, a program would be widely circulated within the ship, which would tell you how many aircraft were required and for what purpose. And this would itemize bomb loads, armament, and all the rest of it. And so, generally during the night, in readiness for what was seen in almost invariably to be a dawn takeoff, there you might be a second or third strike during the day. The aircraft were prepared by the aircrew, by the squadron personnel who armed the aircraft. They would be stowed either on the flight deck, but if there was a major repair required, or they were undergoing one of their routine regular inspections, they would be in the hangar. And the hangar could not accommodate the whole squadron if it was fully embarked and with a full load. And so you normally had a small number of aircraft, or if the weather was fine, you didn't need to keep them in the hangar, a larger number of aircraft on the flight deck where most of the work was done. The aircraft were then prepared, and at a time which was specified, normally about an hour and a quarter before takeoff, the aircrew would be gathered for briefing in the aircrew room, and they would be briefed on what they had to do by the operations officer, who was one of the ship's staff as part of the air department. And he was the one, normally an observer, who did the set up the operations and working out of the ship's operations room. And when the aircrew were briefed, the command would be given to man the aircraft by the commander air, normally, or lieutenant commander flying, and the aircrew would then man their aircraft and prepare for takeoff. And they would be tightly packed in, because everything in the air, in the flight deck, was a matter of precision, and very accurate movements of aircraft were required, which was all done by hand signals, in order to avoid, of course, any possible collision, because you only had to have the slightest collision and there would be damage to the aircraft and it couldn't go. So that was a heinous crime. And people got extremely skillful at it. You took it as part of the course, but it was a skillful business. And then when the time came, normally some of the aircraft on a full range, because there were so many of them, would go off the catapult, and so you'd have a couple of aircraft ready to be loaded onto the catapult, and they would have itemized how many aircraft they would want to go off the catapult. And so they would go off one after another, and on command from the flying control. And then after they had been shot off, the others would have a free takeoff from the after end of the flight deck. But of course, you had a lot of aeroplanes. The aircraft at the front of the range would have less distance to fly up the deck than the ones at the back.
So is that why they needed the catapults?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yes. Also, it was, people said, the safest way of getting into the air. In fact, if you were the fighters tended to go off on the catapults, and the middle range aircraft, like the Fireflies, less frequently, and then the Barracudas or Avengers, as we had later, were at the back of the range because they had the biggest load and so needed the longest time for takeoff. And one endeavoured to get the whole lot off, whatever the strike was going to be, as quickly as possible, because the ship had to turn into wind in order to ensure that you had the wind going straight up and down the flight deck, and that you were going to generate enough wind for your heavily loaded aircraft to be able to take off safely. And more about that in a moment. You would then form up near the ship, and then you would set course, and if you were the senior observer, you would set the course for the squadron, and you would tell the squadron commander where to go, and you would sort of that way. And you would then fly off, do whatever you had to do, and return to the ship. When you returned to the ship, you had a landing drill, and it was then the pilots who took over completely and were in charge of the airplane. Because the observer's responsibility really ended when they'd found the carrier, and he'd returned to the carrier. And then the aircraft would come up by a procedure, which was carefully worked out and much practiced, and one after the other would land on, under the control of a chap with paddles, known as the batsman. And he would be able to indicate to the aircraft whether it was too high or too low or going too slowly on the approach. And the aircraft would come down in the reverse direction to the carrier on its port side, turn in, and you could do this quite accurately, and then just straighten up at the end and land on the carrier. And if you got it right, you could do it extremely smoothly. But it wasn't always like that.
Yes, you were going to talk about safe takeoffs or unsafe takeoffs.
yes. Well, after the Barracudas, Implacable was re-equipped with Avengers, because she was going out of the Pacific, and the Americans were out there in strength, and these Avengers were American aircraft. So we were re-equipped with Avengers before we sailed out to the Pacific, and that was fine. The Avenger was a splendid aircraft. It was tough, it was well used, people knew about it, and you could thump it down the carrier's deck and it wouldn't sort of disintegrate like a Zephyr. However, on the way out to the Pacific, we stopped at Trincomalee in Sri Lanka, Ceylon as it was then known as, and there was a big anchorage at the off Trincomalee, known as China Bay, and there we re-equipped with the latest and allegedly best sort of Avengers, the Avenger Mark II. But we, although they were better aircraft, they were slightly more powerful, more comfortable to drive, and a bit faster as a consequence. These ones had a weakness initially, and that weakness, it took us some time to discover. Some aircraft were lost inexplicably, but gradually people began to realize it was due to loss of power or something, and although I don't think it was ever proven, it was alleged that the reason was that they had spark plugs which were not properly attuned to the size of the new engines. Anyway, they changed the plugs and that was later all right, but in the meantime quite a number of aircraft were lost, some of them with their crews, simply because the engine didn't give the power when it was required. And this was a very serious matter on takeoff. And if you were taking off with your full load of 300-500-pound bombs, the pilots were instructed that if they were, when they were going past the island on takeoff, the island being the superstructure, if they were not getting the revs, which they were supposed to be getting, and they could just glance down and look at the rev counter, they were to abort the takeoff. Well, on one occasion, in which I was involved, the ship had been sent off immediately before joining the rest of the Pacific Fleet for a workup operation based from the Admiralty Islands, where the fleet had an advanced base at a base called Manus, and we were going to carry out a strike for 2 or 3 days on Truk, which was an island in the Marianas that had been the major Japanese base, but they had moved on except for a sort of skeleton staff behind, so it was regarded as a soft target. On this particular occasion, there was a flat calm, and if you were fully loaded, the ship had to have a minimum amount of airspeed, and the ship had difficulty, even going flat out, in generating the airspeed that you needed. And so it searched around for the wind for a bit on this particular morning, and there were the occasional tropical rainstorms, which were not accompanied by wind, just a tremendous heavy downpour. However, wind was found in the end, and the operation was got underway. And I was in the leading aeroplane with the CO, and we set off down the flight deck. And as he went past the island, the CO looked at these rev counters, decided he wasn't getting the revs, so he aborted the takeoff. But the aircraft, which it had been calculated would have enough room to stop, unfortunately slid on a wet deck due to a tropical rainstorm. And it just, but only just, fell over the bows. And now the one thing about the Observer was, the Avenger, that instead of the British ships, which had an inline engine up the front, and a fuselage and construction, which was less well attuned to slow flying. It was very stable, even at very slow speeds, even when it had stalled.